At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at bragworthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Elbridge Colby, the author of The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. The aim of strength is peace. However, right now, a coalition can be formed in the event of an attack on Taiwan. However, NATO, is NATO part of this equation? It doesn't geographically touch upon any of it, but we see now with AUKUS, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States as part of a coalition in the Indo-Pacific dealing with China. Is NATO to get involved? Is that a factor for China?
Yeah, it's a factor. I don't think Europe is going to play a particularly significant role directly in the military balance in the Pacific. What I think the main role, you know, Europe is the secondary theater for us. It's very important, but it's distinctly less important than Asia. And furthermore, the chance of another state becoming or a state becoming hegemonic in that region is far less. I mean, China is half of Asia's GDP, so it stands a very plausible chance of establishing a dominant position in the region. Russia is a much smaller fraction. It's not even the largest state in the region. I mean, Germany is by GDP. So, you know, the threat is less significant, although significant, and the threat is much more limited. And we need to focus on Asia because we're dealing with a superpower there. So that's really got to be our focus. So we are going to have to reduce our exposure. I think we should remain in NATO. But I think the key will be to reduce our conventional obligations in Europe and basically shift those to the Europeans, which in a sense actually was the vision of NATO from the beginning. This was President Eisenhower, you know, vision is actually that SACEUR would be a European and so forth. So this is not doing violence to the basic idea. And moreover, the Europeans can do this. I mean, you know, in fact, a lot of European countries have actually increased defense spending over the last few years. Poland, Brits, Sweden, Finland, I think Denmark and Norway as well. The big problem is Germany. And the real problem here is that there is a real incentive for the Chinese and the Russians to act either collaboratively, deliberately, or opportunistically. Let's say China pulls the trigger on Taiwan and Russia goes in the Baltics or vice versa, right? So this is a serious problem. And America cannot handle this on its own. We do not have the capacity. And we will not, and frankly, it's not consistent with the level of what American defense spending, I think, could reasonably be, you know, by most accounts. But fortunately, we have a solution, which is that the Europeans should do it. And they can and they should. And, you know, if they refuse to do it, they will be the ones who internalize the risk. I don't want that. I actually argued to the Europeans repeatedly, especially the Germans, that this is in their interest, that it's their moral duty, et cetera. But at the end of the day, if we're forced to choose between Asia and Europe, we have to choose Asia.
The example of Russia and Georgia, 2008, Russia and Ukraine, 2014, are those models that the Chinese can use for Taiwan and the Philippines?
I don't think so because, you know, Russia was going after non-NATO allies, right? So China's a much stronger threat and China's ambitions, it seems to me, I mean, what Vladimir Putin wishes in his inner heart, I don't know. But I mean, Russia's plausible aspirations in Europe are much more limited than what China can plausibly hope for. I think the invasion of Crimea is actually something of what you could see in Taiwan, except they basically were welcome. You know, I don't know if they were welcome, but I mean, there's a large Russian-speaking population, as I understand it, in Crimea because the naval base and so forth. That's not going to happen on Taiwan. And then the incursion into eastern Ukraine is actually really a bad outcome. And I think it's been a bad outcome for Russia in the sense that it's made them appear dangerous but resistible, right? I don't know what they've gained by it. I'm sure something. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it hasn't really helped them. If China did something like that, I think it would be backfire. That's why China its incentive is to do pretty much sort of nothing or to go big and make a really big statement that really fundamentally changes things.
Nuclear proliferation. You talk about going nuke proliferation with our allies. How would the coalition acquiring another nuclear power, Japan and Korea, are two possibilities. How would that change the formula, and would that successfully deny China its advantage?
Well, I think I actually have a critique of friendly nuclear proliferation that you don't hear that much these days. It actually echoes an argument Jim Schlesinger made, I think, in the late 60s. But my basic view is that friendly nuclear proliferation is not going to be a panacea. I mean, I could see the South Koreans or the Australians getting nuclear weapons. And if they don't have an American defense umbrella to integrate into, they're going to be toast anyway. And that's basically because nuclear weapons don't, I think, buy you as much as some people think. I think it's credible that a country would launch a nuclear weapon in retaliation to a large-scale nuclear strike or an invasion in which, you know, the population is being massacred. But, I mean, if you're South Korea or Australia and you launch nuclear weapons against China, you are essentially going to be committing suicide because the Chinese, even if you get, probably a lot of your missiles will be shot down by Chinese air defenses and missile defenses, and you will be destroyed because the Chinese will have the ability, and then they will definitely have that, you know, righteous might, that flashing sword of vengeance. So, you know, and what we're worried about here is not that the Chinese are going to come and build pyramids of heads, Tamerlan style. We're worried that the Chinese are going to say to the Australians, you have to kowtow to us, and your future is going to be determined in Canberra. Are you going to, Beijing, are you going to commit suicide to avoid that? No, you're going to live and to fight another day, you know? Okay, so I don't think friendly nuclear proliferation is a panacea, which some people argue. On the other hand, I could see a future in which we lose the conventional military balance. And in this context, the Chinese have an incentive to start and win a conventional war in the Western Pacific. And then the question becomes, are the Americans willing to go nuclear first? And I think the answer to that is questionable. I think there are situations in which we would go nuclear first. I don't think we should take a no first use pledge. But America's not going to launch a large-scale nuclear strike against the Chinese mainland because we've lost a conventional war. So I'd rather avoid this very difficult question by making sure we do have an effective conventional defense. But I think our backup here would be, in addition to doing that and keeping the conventional balance as competitive as possible, it may, at the end of the day, not be the worst thing to have countries like Australia and Japan also have nuclear forces that are integrated in the broad sense into the overall alliance deterrent. And here I think the analogy is the United Kingdom and to some extent France, more the United Kingdom, which, you know, the official position of the North Atlantic Alliance is that the independent nuclear deterrence of the United Kingdom and France contribute to the security of NATO. Well, basically the idea being that, you know, back in the old days when we faced an overwhelming, you know, theater advantage from the Soviet Union, it was good that it was good from an overall deterrence perspective that the only decision maker was not in Washington. Because the Soviets might have been able to intimidate Washington into not pulling the trigger, but could they be confident that London or France wouldn't do it? And those were countries that had major militaries, you know, strategic cultures. It wasn't like giving, you know, Luxembourg a nuclear weapon. But I think that's the way I think about it. And I think the Chinese should understand this, that if they attain conventional dominance, this is always something that we as the anti-hegemonic coalition can do. And the Indians already have nuclear weapons, right? So there's already some of this that's already happened.
The book is about a scenario that will never happen if we're lucky and good. The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Elbridge Colby is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.